Hello again, everyone. Rich Catino here with Mets Clubhouse Confidential. And another interesting off-season week for the Mets, and two main things we're going to hit upon in this show. One is we're going to hit upon the fact that the Trevor Bauer sweepstakes, the way it was covered by the media and the way it was analyzed, is all off base. Mets lose out on Bauer. He ends up going to the Dodgers. We'll talk about that and what it means to the National League. And why it's not the worst thing in the world that could have happened to the Mets. And then today, the Mets land a center fielder, Albert Amaro Jr. And I think it's a great signing for the Mets because it once again brings better defense to the team at a less price than the market would have bared for a player of that ability. And we'll get to the whole Jackie Bradley Jr. Versus Almora Jr. debate, because it's much like the JT Realmuto, James McCann debate. We'll talk about what this means to the Met lineup and what it would mean in a DH setting and what it would mean in a non-DH setting. And we're also going to talk a little bit about how the Mets offseason has made it an interesting National League East, in which I think the Mets are no worse than co-favorites with the Braves to win that division with the present roster they have now. We'll also chat about what else the Mets might do, adding a starting pitcher or maybe adding an infielder. There's still options out there. And yes, we'll talk about how Major League Baseball needs to let us know whether the season's going to start on time. Because if it does, then spring training is going to open in a couple of weeks with pitchers and catchers reporting. Will they be reporting to? Who knows? And we'll get to all of that in a moment. We'll be back with more of Mets Clubhouse Confidential in a minute. But first, I want to talk to you about two of my most favorite things to do. And those of you who know me know this is the case. One is talk sports, and two is eat great Italian food. And I'm going to send you to places where you could do both of those things. First of all, the eating of the Italian food. St. John's of Arthur Avenue in Portchester, on Westchester Avenue in Portchester, right off the 287 Parkway, right up to Westchester Avenue. Go in, say hello to John for me, tell him Bridge sent you, and whatever it is you like. If you like Northern Italian cuisine, it's a great place to eat. If you like Southern Italian cuisine, it's a great place to eat. If you're more of a seafood eater, if you just want a slice of pizza, you want a nice Italian hero, or I'll call it as he calls it, a hoagie. A great place to watch sports, too, as the restaurant has an addendum to it now that has a sports bar in there that can watch sports all night long. St. John's of Arthur Avenue. And if you're home and want it delivered to your house in this pandemic world we live in, stjohnsofarthuravenue.com. You can order it online, and it'll be at your house before you know it, St. John's of Arthur Avenue. And of course, talking sports. We all love to do it. Anyone who's listening to this show loves to do it as well. And one of the great places to hear about sports, to read about sports, is the number one sports website in New York, thenewyorkextra.com. But it does far more than sports. It covers news and entertainment. And on the sports side, you get your Mets stuff from me on it, but you also get so much more. You get coverage of the Knicks and Rangers seasons as they've gotten underway. And how the Jets are going to, what they're going to do with that second pick. In fact, in the coming week, me and Len Robbins are going to have a fierce debate as to what the Jets might do with that second pick. So, thenewyorkextra.com. Log on to it now, and you can talk sports. And if you're doing it from your house, at the same time, order food from St. John's of Arthur Avenue. You get a great Italian food in your home, you know, pandemic-free, and you're able to read about sports. TheNewYorkExtra.com and St. John's of Arthur Avenue, a duo that's very hard to beat. Before I get to the Almora signing today, I want to talk about the Trevor Bauer sweepstakes. And I think one of the things that, you know, was really interesting about it all was that everyone did what they were supposed to do in this scenario. Trevor Bauer and his agent were proper in bringing as many teams into the forefront as they could. And there was nothing they really did wrong in this whole negotiations. In fact, she's an agent that is going to get more clients if she deals with it this way. And I'll tell you why. A lot of agents out there want the best deal for them. And that means the highest salary so they can get the highest commission. But she was looking for the best deal with what the player wanted. And ultimately, looking back, the player wanted to be in Los Angeles. And in order to do that at a price that was, you know, in their range, they had to bring other teams into the forefront, and they did that. So the agent and Trevor Bauer did nothing wrong in this scenario. The New York Mets did nothing wrong either. They looked at Trevor Bauer and how he would add to this team. And look, the Met rotation is very good right now, but with Trevor Bauer, it would have been off the charts. And they went and gave an offer to him. The Dodgers did the right thing here too. Once they knew the offer was out there, they had to look at their payroll and see what they wanted to do with their pitching. And, you know, the addition of Trevor Bauer indicates to me at least there's a little bit of worry and concern the Dodgers have about Clayton Kershaw and his ability to stay on the field all season. So that's where it all went. And everyone tried to make this on social media of, you know, this one did this wrong, that wrong, same old Mets. Let me make this simple that you'll all understand it. It's not the same old Mets. It's not the same old Mets when you acquire Francisco Lindor. It's not the same old Mets when you get the catcher that you need. It's not the same old Mets when you add two pitchers to the bullpen that are going to make this bullpen even better than it was last year. And more importantly, it's not the same old Mets when you've acquired the number one available player in the offseason in all of baseball in Francisco Lindor. So don't sit here and tell me it's the same old Mets, because it's not the same old Mets. Okay? And while we're at it, where are the Yankees in the Trevor Bauer sweepstakes? Don't they need pitchers? They decided they were going to take another route, and I'm not blaming them for it, but they decided they were going to take a route on Corey Kluber and Taillon and two pitchers that pitched a grand total of one inning last year. I'm not saying it's not going to work out. I'm not saying it wasn't the proper thing to do. I'm saying this, and when you build a Major League Baseball team, there's no one path to it that's the only path. You can build a team that could score runs and maybe doesn't have as much pitching. And then I'll get to this with the Almora signing. A lot of teams have won championships with a weak-hitting shortstop that can really field his position. Now, the Mets don't have a weak-hitting shortstop. They have a strong-hitting shortstop that could field his position. So in constructing a lineup and a roster, you could make the weak-hitting, solid defensive player be in some other position, like center field, for instance. And I don't know why people don't understand that. But getting back to the Trevor Bauer sweepstakes, yes, it gives the Dodgers a great pitching staff. And then I heard this other nonsense on Twitter, how if the Mets play the Dodgers in the playoffs, how are they ever going to compete against that staff? Well, I heard the same things in 2015 when two pitchers named Clayton Kershaw and Zach Greinke were facing the Mets in a playoff series. And by the way, that was a best of five, not even best of seven. And Jacob DeGrom, the best pitcher in baseball. And make sure you understand that, fans. He is the best pitcher in baseball. Won a road playoff game with another guy who's in this rotation doing something he never did before, come out of the bullpen in relief to make sure the Mets got to the National League Championship Series. And I'll say this, a healthy Noah Syndergaard combined with Jacob DeGrom, I will put that duo up against any duo in baseball. I'll put them up against Cole and whoever you have as the Yankee second starter. I'll put them up against Scherzer and Strasburg. I'll put them up against Kershaw and Bauer. And with the Met lineup and the Met bullpen, 99 times out of 100, the Mets are going to win that game. That's the pure and simple of it. Now, would Bauer have made an even more potent rotation? Absolutely. But at what price? And then you'd be bringing a guy into the clubhouse that's making more than Jacob deGrom when he's not as good as Jacob deGrom. And who knows what kind of behind-the-scenes issues that could have caused. But again, all the parties in the situation did what they were supposed to do. The agent did what she was supposed to do. Trevor Bauer did what he was supposed to do. The Mets did what they were supposed to do. The Dodgers did what they were supposed to do. He ends up on the Dodgers. Nobody went above, beyond board. Nobody did anything behind anyone's back. This is negotiations. And I'll tell you the way negotiations work, because this is something I have a little experience with. You go high, I go lower. You go high, I go lower. If we can keep doing that until we meet in the middle, we'll have a deal. If we can't, we won't. It's that simple. And I think sometimes people don't understand that. We'll be back with my take on the Almora signing right after this. So Super Bowl Sunday launched this morning, and the Met news took center stage as they landed the center fielder that they've been looking for, Albert Almora Jr. And people say, well, I would have rather had Jackie Bradley Jr. Well, if you look at these two players, and let me talk about Almora first, because this guy, we sometimes forget what a high draft pick he was by the Cubs and Theo Epstein. So he's a guy that came to professional baseball with a lot of skills. Defensively, he's as good as it gets in center field. And I think defensively he's better than Jackie Bradley Jr. in center field. Now, Jackie Bradley Jr. might be a bit of a better hitter, but that's not significant enough for me to have a long-term contract with someone who's in center field. The second aspect of this, from what I understand, it's a one-year deal. So that gives the Mets a lot more flexibility down the road. And let's keep in mind, the Mets have a center fielder in their system, which probably 2 or 3 years away, but he's someone that was a high draft pick and someone they have a lot of hopes for. Whether those hopes come to fruition remains to be seen, but that's another reason why you don't commit to a long-term deal. And from what I understand, Jackie Bradley Jr. was looking for a 3-4 year contract at the very least. The other part of this that I think everyone has to consider and understand is that you can't really figure out everything about your lineup without knowing whether the DH is going to be in the National League or not. And from what I understand, it'll definitely be around in 2022. But in 2021, it's a flip of the coin right now. And that being said, when you look at this acquisition, it kind of helps the Mets in both of those scenarios. Let's take the non-DH scenario first. Okay, in a non-DH scenario, you have 8 hitters in your lineup and a pitcher batting, so you still have to make room for Dominic Smith and to a certain extent Jose Martinez to get at bats. And I think in the non-DH setting, what you do is you work with a platoon. You platoon Brandon Nimmo and Almora in center field, and you platoon Dominic Smith and Jose Martinez in left field. And on the days where Almora is not starting, especially in games where you have a lead late, he becomes a defensive replacement that you put in center field, and you move Brandon Nimmo to left, taking out either Dominic Smith or Jose Martinez. And that's in the non-DH world. In the DH world, it takes a whole different mindset, okay? I think in a DH world, Almora is your center fielder and Nimmo is your left fielder. And then your DH becomes a circular collection, meaning that at times it'll be Jose Martinez, at times it'll be Dominic Smith, at times it'll be Pete Alonso with Dominic Smith playing first and Brandon Nimmo still in left. Your defense is better in the outfield that way, and you have usage of all these players that you bring in. And that's assuming the Mets don't bring an infielder into this lineup, which I'll get to later in the show. So Almora becomes, in a DH world, your everyday center fielder, with Brandon Nimmo pretty much your everyday left fielder, and then working in the DH first base scenario, guys like Martinez, Alonso, and Smith, making sure they all get their at-bats. J.D. Davis is the third baseman in this scenario, but you can also spend some time with him in the outfield or DH. I think in the DH world, it gives the Mets a tremendous amount of flexibility. In the non-DH world, the Mets are a little put into a corner on how they're going to find at-bats for Dominic Smith, but I think at that point, you platoon both in center field and left field and go from there. Now, would I have done the same thing with Jackie Bradley Jr.? Maybe. Maybe not. But I would have been doing it spending a lot more money and committing a lot more years. And I think sometimes when fans look at off-season acquisitions, they look at it like they would in their rotisserie baseball fantasy drafts. You can't just take the 1 year you're in and wedge all the best players you can into that roster. You have to think about how you're going to get playing time, how you get your best lineup out there, how you can do all that stuff. But you also got to think about the long-term effect of one-year contracts versus multi-year contracts. And the other part of this that I think is important to note is that you want to go with more short-term because you don't want a center fielder who's eventually going to have to be moved to a corner outfield position. And that was what it would have been like with Springer. And I think that one of the things you have to also ascertain is what you're going to do with Michael Conforto. Now, the money you've saved here, you have three potential big players entering their walk years for the Mets. Michael Conforto, Francisco Lindor, and Noah Syndergaard. Now, for Syndergaard, you got to wait to see what he looks like when he comes back. And I think the true evaluation of whether you're going to re-up him isn't going to be there until you know that. And the true feelings of what he wants to do isn't going to be there until he knows that. So you have to put that to the side a little bit. But the Conforto and Lindor signings need to be done. Now, if you told me the Mets were going to get Carrasco and Lindor, and Lindor might be gone after a year, I still would have made the trade they made. But you really want to sign him long-term so he could stay in New York long-term. And what fans have to understand is if you got Realmuto and or Springer, absolutely all three of them wouldn't be back. You'd be lucky if you get one of them back. And I don't know if that's the way you want to go. And people say, well, you know, Cohen has all this money. Yeah, but he's not looking to burn it at the stake, the money. You have a lot. There's a reason why Steve Cohen has a lot of money. He's made good decisions in his career and wise decisions and didn't make, you know, outlandish decisions. And he always looked ahead. And that's the way he's going to run this franchise. And one of the reasons that Sandy Alderson fits in so well with that modus operandi. But the other thing the Mets get in Almora is a player with a tremendously high on-the-field IQ. And I use as the illustration of that moment Game 7 of the World Series. And let's just remember that Game 7 that the Cubs played in the World Series. They were down 3-1 in that series. And they came back to force a Game 7. They get to Game 7. They have the Game 1 and Aroldis Chapman. And we've seen him do it with the Yankees twice. When teams are set to advance or win a championship, he generally gives up a home run that blows the save and puts everything in duress. We've seen it the last 2 years with the Yankees. He's done it more than any pitcher in Major League history. And he did it on that night. And the Cubs had to get to the 10th inning. And there was a fly ball hit by Chris Bryant. Amor had come in as a pinch runner after I think Schwarber got a hit. And he tagged from first to second on a fly ball with a tremendously gifted play, looking at a couple things, knowing the arm of the outfielder in question, knowing that he had time to get back to tag up to first base, and knowing the position the outfielder was in when he caught the ball. Those are all things that you can't necessarily teach a player to know. Those are things that are in high baseball IQ. He got to that base. Cubs ended up scoring a couple of runs, and they needed a couple because I believe the Indians scored a run in the bottom half of the frame. But the Cubs won the World Series. And if you talk to Cub fans, I'm sure they'll remember that moment. Just like Met fans remember the Buckner moment. Or just like Met fans remember the Agbayani or Todd Pratt moment. It wasn't the moment that ended the series on that moment, but it had a big impact on the way the series ended. And I've seen Almora do a lot of that on the field. Defensively, he positions himself well to throw the ball back to the infield. He's fundamentally sound. And I think he's going to be a player that Met fans enjoy watching. And when I look at everything that this roster has done, what this roster has produced in this offseason, I think it's real interesting. Number one, I think that, you know, they've improved the bullpen. They got a righty and a lefty added into that bullpen, Manny Loop, and both of them will perform well, and both of them will contribute to a bullpen that improved last year. Diaz got better last year. You're probably going to have Seth Lugo in that bullpen unless he's in the rotation. And when you talk about a bullpen of Diaz, May, Lugo, Loop, Familia, Betances, that's got the chance to be an earth-shatteringly great bullpen. A lot of it's going to hinge on Diaz continuing his development and return to being a closer, which I think he will do, and what Betances and Familia will be like after a down year for both of them. And there's also the chance down the road that they'll add, maybe re-add Justin Wilson to the mix, making an even stronger bullpen. But that bullpen's pretty strong right now. And I know Met fans are saying we didn't get Brad Hand, but you got Loop, who's going to serve that left-handed role well, and you have people that can close. You have two that have closed recently in Diaz and Loop. You've had a couple others that have closed in their career in Betances and Familia. You have a lot of stuff that Lugo can bring you in that bullpen too. So that's a bullpen that has a chance to be a really good one. They added a catcher who's going to help defensively, and he'll hit some. He'll hit some long balls too. And I think, you know, he's another bat in the lineup that's right-handed, but he's also a catcher that's going to command the game and work well with the pitchers. And that's something I think the Mets were looking for in the offseason. They're also looking for a stronger defense up the middle. And they've improved their defense behind the plate. They've obviously improved their defense at shortstop with Lindor. And I think it's safe to say they've improved their defense at second with McNeil over Cano. And now Almora in center field, he brings the defense up a notch too. So the Mets have improved in so many areas on this team. And I think that, you know, one of the things that, you know, they wanted to do was do that because they knew that pitching was still going to be the fulcrum of this roster. When you have the best pitcher in the game, it has to be. Adding Carrasco to the rotation is huge. Adding Stroman to the rotation, I think that's an acquisition we can't forget about either. And then David Peterson, who pitched really well last year. And then there'll be a fifth starter. I honestly don't think that fifth starter is going to be Seth Lugo. I think it's going to come from outside the organization. I think James Paxton would be perfect in that role, because I think he performed pretty well last year for the Yankees. But I also think he's another lefty in a left-handed laden division. And I think he will benefit from a pitching coach that will work with him to his strengths in the way Jeremy Hefner does and in the way his previous pitching coaches did not. So I think that all of that indicates to me that the Mets are at the very least co-favorites in this division with the Braves. If I was ranking the division right now, I'd rank the Mets 1, the Braves 2. The Braves had a good offseason too. They added some pitchers and they re-signed Marcell Ozuna, which is big for them. They have Freddie Freeman coming up and next year, but I think they'll address that during this season and get him under it too. So the Braves and the Mets to me are co-favorites. I think the Phillies and Nationals are good teams, but they're both a notch below where the Mets and Braves are right now. And the Marlins will keep improving. So it's not like you're going to play the Marlins and say, well, if I got 18 games with the Marlins, I got to win 15 of them. The Marlins have some good young pitching, and I still think they could be a factor in this division a year from now, but not necessarily the year we're going into now. I think they benefited from the 60-game schedule. Give them a lot of credit. They perform well with all the things that going on with COVID on their team. They still perform well, and Don Mattingly deserves a heck of a lot of credit for that. I think they will be a factor in the race, but in a longer season, I think they might have trouble keeping up with the other teams on the top of this division, like the Braves and the Mets, because the Braves and the Mets will have more depth than they would. But certainly the Marlins are a team to watch in the near future. And I think, you know, Mets may not be done either yet, so who knows if they might add an infielder. You know, Justin Turner's a free agent. Now, the Mets right now have J.D. Davis at third base, but who knows if Chris Bryant is available from the Cubs. If the Cubs are looking to decrease payroll, and certainly the trading of Yu Darvish indicated to me that, and Schwarber as well, indicated to me that they are looking to cut payroll. So certainly there's some things out there that the Mets could do, and but right now, I think this roster, the way it constitutes now, is a 90-win roster. And when you're a 90-win roster in this NL East, you'll be in the mix for at least battling for the top playoff spot. And if not getting that, certainly getting a wild card. So I think that's kind of where we are with the Mets and their offseason acquisitions. When we come back, we'll talk a little bit about the Mickey Callaway story right after this. We'll be back with more of Mets Clubhouse Confidential in a minute. But first, I want to talk to you about two of my most favorite things to do. And those of you who know me know this is the case. One is talk sports, and two is eat great Italian food. And I'm going to send you to places where you could do both of those things. First of all, the eating of the Italian food. St. John's of Arthur Avenue in Portchester, on Westchester Avenue in Portchester, right off the 287 Parkway, right up to Westchester Avenue. Go in, say hello to John for me, tell him Bridge sent you, and whatever it is you like. If you like Northern Italian cuisine, it's a great place to eat. If you like Southern Italian cuisine, it's a great place to eat. If you're more of a seafood eater, if you just want a slice of pizza, you want a nice Italian hero, or I'll call it as he calls it, a hoagie. A great place to watch sports too, as the restaurant has an addendum to it now that has a sports bar in there that can watch sports all night long. St. John's of Arthur Avenue. And if you're home and want it delivered to your house in this pandemic world we live in, stjohnsofarthuravenue.com. You can order it online and it'll be at your house before you know it. St. John's of Arthur Avenue. And of course, talking sports. We all love to do it. Anyone who's listening to this show loves to do it as well. And one of the great places to hear about sports, to read about sports, is the number one sports website in New York, thenewyorkextra.com. But it does far more than sports. It covers news and entertainment. And on the sports side, you get your Mets stuff from me on it, but you also get so much more. You get coverage of the Knicks and Rangers seasons as they've gotten underway. And how the Jets are going to, what they're going to do with that second pick. In fact, in the coming week, me and Len Robbins are going to have a fierce debate as to what the Jets might do with that second pick. So, thenewyorkextra.com. Log on to it now, and you can talk sports. And if you're doing it from your house, at the same time, order food from St. John's of Arthur Avenue. You get a great Italian food in your home, you know, pandemic-free, and you're able to read about sports. TheNewYorkExtra.com and St. John's of Arthur Avenue, a duo that's very hard to beat. We are back on Met Clubhouse Confidential, and I wanted to talk a little bit about the Mickey Callaway situation. And look, we live in awful times. And I think that, you know, we've heard the side of the story, although it was fictional sources, fictional names, I should say, not fictional sources. But I would love to hear Mickey Callaway's side of the story. I can tell you, being around the Mets every day during Mickey Callaway's tenure, I never saw anything remotely resembling what was written in that article. That doesn't mean it didn't take place. It could have mean I just missed it. It could have meant that I wasn't lurking around every corner looking for it. It could mean any of those things. So, but I do want to hear his side of the story. And the reason I want to hear his side of the story is because the statement he made after the story came out had a word in there that always worries you. It had the word consensual. And I don't know what he meant by that. And then he went on to say his wife's aware of it, which was even a wilder part of the response. But I do think we need to hear the side of the story, his side of the story. And we haven't heard that yet. So until I hear that side of the story, I can't make a determination not only on the validity of it, but what to do about it. And I certainly think the vetting process for employment in any line of work needs to be looked at. But you also then get into the whole thing of how much is vetting and how much is getting into the personal life of someone that really isn't any business of yours. Now, if Mickey Callaway assaulted or made a woman feel uncomfortable while he was manager of the Mets or pitching coach of the Indians or the Dodgers or the Angels, I should say, that needs to be investigated. And I think Major League Baseball will investigate it. But I can also tell you this, that, and I don't know, maybe because when I cover a game, I'm just totally into the game and all those extraneous things that go around the game, I have very little time for. But people say that this was something that was talked about ad nauseum. I never heard it talked about. Now, that doesn't mean it wasn't talked about. I'm only telling you what it is I know. And I think that, you know, on the heels of the Jared Porter thing and on the heels of the Mickey Callaway thing, these things need to be investigated better. But I also think that if reporters were being made to feel uncomfortable around players or managers or other colleagues, I think they have to work for a place that they feel comfortable with going to them about this. And I want to know where these people's employers were when all this was going on. If these people went to their bosses where they worked, why weren't the Mets called? And maybe they were called because people say there was some kind of a something that was investigated in 2018. I hadn't heard anything about it, so I'm not sure what that is. But You have to think that if I had a woman working for me and I owned a newspaper or I owned a TV station or I owned a radio station or I owned a website, and she was made, feel uncomfortable by somebody she interacted with, whether it was a player, a manager, a team executive, another person in the media, I would go right to the root of that problem and find out what it was. But again, that woman needs to have the comfortability of being able to go to her bosses with it. And the bosses then need to go to where the root of the problem was and have an investigation. And sexual harassment laws in New York State are very clear for everybody to see. When someone brings an allegation, it has to be investigated. And it has to be investigated by someone who's not directly either working for or have people reporting to them, this person reporting to them. It has to be done by an objective source. So I'm wondering why the companies that these women work for didn't come to the teams, didn't come to the Indians, didn't come to the Angels, didn't come to the Mets. And in Jared Porter's case, didn't come to the Cubs. And because that's the only way that you can properly investigate this. Don't know the reason why. Now, like I said, the reason could be that person didn't feel comfortable with going to someone in their own company about it. It could also be that the relationship was consensual gone bad, which is the reason I want to hear the other side of it. We've already heard, even though it's, you know, made up names to protect the contacts in the Athletic article, I think it's important for us to hear the other side of the story. And eventually, this could become a court case in which both parties are going to have to tell their side of the story with their hand on the Lord's Bible, which, if they lie about it, is perjury. So I don't think this story is anywhere close to being done. And I think that we have to clearly identify what the story is and get both parties' takes. That's what's called an investigation. And what we have now is just the tip of the iceberg. And a lot more to come from this story. We'll be back with some final thoughts right after this. We'll be back with more of Mets Clubhouse Confidential in a minute. But first I want to talk to you about two of my most favorite things to do. And those of you who know me know this is the case. One is talk sports, and two is eat great Italian food. And I'm going to send you to places where you could do both of those things. First of all, the eating of the Italian food. St. John's of Arthur Avenue in Portchester, on Westchester Avenue in Portchester, right off the 287 Parkway, right up to Westchester Avenue. Go in, say hello to John for me, tell him Rich sent you, and whatever it is you like. If you like Northern Italian cuisine, it's a great place to eat. If you like Southern Italian cuisine, it's a great place to eat. If you're more of a seafood eater, if you just want a slice of pizza, you want a nice Italian hero, or I'll call it as he calls it, a hoagie. a great place to watch sports too, as the restaurant has an addendum to it now that has a sports bar in there that can watch sports all night long. St. John's of Arthur Avenue. And if you're home and want it delivered to your house in this pandemic world we live in, stjohnsofarthuravenue.com. You can order it online and it'll be at your house before you know it. St. John's of Arthur Avenue. And of course, talking sports. We all love to do it. Anyone who's listening to this show loves to do it as well. And one of the great places to hear about sports, to read about sports, is the number one sports website in New York, thenewyorkextra.com. But it does far more than sports. It covers news and entertainment. And on the sports side, you get your Met stuff from me on it, but you also get so much more. You get coverage of the Knicks and Rangers seasons as they've gotten underway. And how the Jets are going to, what they're going to do with that second pick. In fact, in the coming week, me and Len Robbins are going to have a fierce debate as to what the Jets might do with that second pick. So, the NewYorkExtra.com. Log on to it now, and you can talk sports. And if you're doing it from your house, at the same time, order food from St. John's of Arthur Avenue. You get a great Italian food in your home, you know, pandemic-free, and you're able to read about sports. TheNewYorkExtra.com and St. John's of Arthur Avenue, a duo that's very hard to beat. In the final segment of the show today, I want to talk a little bit about the decisions that Major League Baseball has to make. It has to make pretty quickly. And we touched upon some of them earlier in the show. One is the universal DH. And I think at the root of all these issues, whether it's universal DH, expanded playoffs, whether the season's going to be delayed or pushed back, I think you have to remember that Major League Baseball owners and the Players Association are in the midst of preparing for how they're going to negotiate after the 2021 season as the collective bargaining agreement has expired. And so much has happened since the last collective bargaining agreement. We've had a pandemic. We also had, in the prior years before the pandemic, a definite kind of almost self-imposed salary cap by the owners in how they negotiated, or more properly, didn't negotiate for free agents. And the pandemic's kind of hidden all that, but I think that was a main gripe that the players had, that we were moving towards a salary cap situation, even though it wasn't on paper, and that was prohibiting the movement of players via free agency. But the other part of the of it that I think the Major League Baseball Players Association has to remember is that the universal DH is going to occur. They just have to find out what they want back from the owners. And I always thought it was going to be the reverse, because if you have a DH with the 15 some odd teams in the National League, that's prospectively a high salary income that's coming the way of players. And to me, then having expanded playoffs, to me would be a natural give back from the players to the owners. Of course, I'm looking at it logically, which may be my first mistake in analyzing Major League Baseball player union talks. So that's a big one. Another big one is the minor leagues. And I think the Major League Baseball Players Association should look into making players in the minor leagues part of their cartel, part of their union, okay? Making sure that those players are taken advantage, aren't taken advantage of at the minor league level. And some of them are big prospects and won't be taken advantage of, but I'm talking about the guys that, you know, spend 4 or 5 years riding buses to pursue a dream that either is so far away they can't even conceive of being a major league player, or that never occurs. And by that, I don't necessarily only mean lifting their salaries a bit, their minimum salaries, but providing some benefits for them when they decide to hang up their spikes and don't get that movement. Because in a lot of ways, those players have spent 5, 6 years of their, you know, wage-earning life in any other business at poverty standards of living to chase a dream. And I think that the other part of it is minor league baseball in small towns in America are a big part of the summer culture in those areas. And Major League Baseball shouldn't forget that either. I also think that they have to look at the playoff structure. And they have to look at it and say, is this the time to have a massive restructuring of Major League Baseball division alignments? I don't know. Everyone talks about having one league with, you know, the Mets and Yankees in the same division and you know, Dodgers and Angels and Cubs and the White Sox in the same divisions. I'm thinking of it a little differently. I'm thinking this may be time to have four divisions in each league. You would have an East, you would have a South, a Central, and a West, or an East, Central, Midwest, and West. And each of those, you know, will have four teams in each division. That means it would be 16 teams in each league, so you have to think about expansion and things like that. But and then my playoff format would be pretty simple. The top two teams in each division finishing get automatic bids to the playoffs, and then you have two wildcard teams. And that's a total of 10 playoff teams in each league. And what you basically do is you have a one-game playoff where the seven seed faces the 10 seed, and the 8 seed faces the 9 seed, and that gets you down to eight teams in each division, and then you have your quarterfinals starting. So teams that are seeded 1 through 6 would automatically not have to play in that one-game playoff. It'll only be teams 7 through 10. Now, the one drawback in the situation is more than half the teams that in baseball are going to make the playoffs. So maybe you limit it. Maybe you say it's the best team in each division, and then you make the wild cards form 8. But I think one of the things about last year's playoffs, even though there were no fans in the stands, and I think for the most part, and I think fans in the stands would have made it so much more interesting, is that that extra round of playoffs provided some pretty good moments. I thought, you know, it gave the Marlins, a young team that's building, a chance to make the playoffs and have those players have some playoff experience, which I think was great. I think the Braves-Reds series was great. And so I don't mind having those 8 playoff teams in each league. I don't think that that's a terrible thing to do. So if that's the case, if you have 4 divisions in each league, maybe you just make the top 2 teams in each division make the playoffs and constitute those 8. And you don't deal with the wild card scenario I mentioned earlier in this segment. But I think these are the things baseball has to sit down and figure out. I think they also have to figure out, where are we with interleague play? Has interleague play become less useful now? I still think in this town, people get excited when the Mets play the Yankees, but is it that way all throughout baseball? And I don't know if it is. I don't know if it isn't. So that's something they have to figure out. And if interleague play has served its purpose, then maybe you think about a more massive restructuring of divisions, putting the Mets and Yankees, say, in the same division, putting the Angels and the Dodgers in the same division, putting the Giants and A's in the same division, Cubs and White Sox. I think it leaves teams that don't have that natural rival a little out in the cold. But maybe it becomes, you know, 4 divisions in total in baseball. And there's no American League and there's no National League. It's just like the other leagues do, where any team can face any other team, theoretically at least, in the finals of that sport. And maybe you have the 4 divisions and you get your your 16 playoff teams, half the teams make the playoffs in baseball, and you just rank them seeds 1 through 16, and that's how you do it. You do a best 2 out of 3, and then a 3 out of 5, and then the 2 4 out of 7 rounds. So all this has to be determined, and I think the only reason I bring all this up is there's so much for them to consider, and to me, right now, the DH is a no-brainer. It benefits both parties. It benefits the owners in a number of ways because, even though they don't want to admit it, the pitchers don't come to bat. There's less of a chance for them to get hurt. Offensively, their teams become more exciting. and the National League teams have more options with how they carve out their lineups and get their players rest, it will help all the teams. From a player standpoint, it's a no-brainer because of all the salaries that brings. You know, when you look at the Mets, for example, without a DH, they're going to be hard-pressed to find at-bats for Dominic Smith and Pete Alonso and Jose Martinez and any other people they add, you know, on a consistent basis. But with a DH, you got that extra 4 or 5 at-bats a game you can give someone that in some ways might be considered a day off. You can rest your catcher and play your backup catcher, but still play, have your primary catcher's bat in the lineup. There's so much that I think it makes for a better product. And believe me, I'm a person that was against the DH for years. I'm a traditionalist in a lot of ways in the way I like baseball. But the time had come to make a change. And they made it last year. And now, if we go back to the National League to not having it, that puts certain teams at a disadvantage. And I think it hurts the Mets. And I think it hurts a lot of teams in the Mets division, too. So I think it's something that they really have to think through. And then I want to get to the pandemic. And we're still in a pandemic. And anyone who doesn't think we are, just, you know, watch the news. You know, we have vaccines, but the way those vaccines are going to be carved out and distributed still remains to be seen and how well that will be. And that's one of the big things, because I think the owners want fans in the stands. They lost a boatload of money last year without the fans in the stands. And I think having fans in the stands would make them more open to negotiating with players on other issues, because all of a sudden revenue is coming in. So it's a big thing. But I think, you know, and I can only speak from a personal standpoint, I've covered spring training every year since 1984, and I don't know if there's a spring training in Florida, whether I'm even going to go. I don't know how I feel about getting in a plane right now. I don't know how I feel about that. I covered games last year by going to the games and, you know, in a very social distance way, and the Mets did a great job of making us all feel comfortable and safe. And if I have to do my job that way, I will. But I would have preferred to have done it with fans in the stands. I would prefer to have done it where I can have interaction with players. And I think all the stuff that's gone on in the last 12 months with all the issues, and, you know, we mentioned, you know, the issues with female reporters. I just don't think the clubhouses are ever going to open again for reporters. Ever, ever, ever. I think there'll be that press conference setting where there's a lot of press conference where, but I don't think clubhouses will be open again in not only baseball, but in all the sports. And I think that it's a way of the teams managing the interaction between the media and players. And for a number of reasons, they've wanted to do that for a long time. And the things that have happened in the last few months are only going to be more reasons to do that. So I think that a lot has to be determined. But to me, if I was running baseball, I'd push everything down a month right now. Pitchers and catchers are supposed to report the middle of this month, which, if I'm looking at my calendar right, that's a couple of weeks. I think you just push that to the middle of March for now. And think about maybe having the spring training sites and games in the local market rather than in the spring training facilities of the teams. I think that'll be a little challenging with some teams, particularly the Blue Jays, who might have to play in Buffalo. But I think that, you know, you start spring training in mid-March, you have like a 5, 6, 7 week, you know, portal, and then you start the season May 1st or even May 15th or even Memorial Day weekend. And you figure out what that'll be. Is it 154 games? Is it 162? I thought originally in the middle of the winter that I would have started the season June 1st, had the spring training at the team's homes rather than their spring training homes starting in the middle of April. And in June 1st, you'd be able to get a 100-game schedule in. You know, it's 25 games a month, plus you would have your 5 or 6 off days throughout the month. Now, if you start it May 1st, you can think about maybe having maybe 130-game schedule. And then you got to figure out how you want the schedule to look. You know, you certainly want teams to play teams in their division as frequently as they did in the 162-game setting, which was 18, 19 games a year. But then you got to figure out, what are you doing with the interleague? And with travel, what are you doing with the teams in your league and the other divisions? Are the Mets going to make 2 long trips to California in a pandemic setting? And again, how vaccinations have been given to players and fans and team executives, that's all going to become a big part of this decision-making process. But right now, with so much of that up in the air, I would just at least temporarily push pitchers and catchers report date to the middle of March. And maybe more vaccine news comes out by then. Maybe players have been vaccinated. You got players who maybe have spent times out of the country in the offseason, and you wonder what they might bring with them in terms of being a carrier of this dreadful disease. There's so many things you have to figure out with this. And to say you're steadfast in starting the season April 1st, and I would love it. I would love to be sitting in D.C. for the Met National opener with Scherzer and DeGrom scheduled to pitch. I love baseball, and I would love to be there as I'm scheduled to be there. But I have to also be realistic as to what exactly where we are in this pandemic setting. A lot to consider for Major League Baseball, a lot to consider for all of us. Stay safe and healthy, and we'll talk to you next week on Mets Clubhouse Confidential.